Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 104 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and today I'm joined by nobody. That's right, it's just me. But don't worry, you won't have to listen to me the whole show. In fact, I'm just going to kick it off and let others do the hard work. So unless this is the first time you've listened to the podcast, you know that we normally have co-hosts Rob Mark, Dan Webb, and David Vanderhoof, as well as an interesting guest. Well, since this week's show falls on the 4th of July holiday here in the U.S., we decided to take some time off. But we didn't want to leave you without your dose of the Airplane Geeks, so this week we have a few previously recorded segments for you. First, Dan and Courtney Miller provide a little airline industry news and commentary. Rob Mark has a special announcement about AirVenture 2010. Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast will come in with their Australia desk report, where you'll hear Anthony as the voice. And then David brings us some interviews he recorded at Mid-Atlantic Air Museum's World War II commemorative weekend. Be sure to see the airplanegeeks.com website for some of David's photos from the event. So let's get started, and I'll see you on the other end.
So hi, everyone. This is Dan. Of course, I have some airline news going on, but I decided to get creative. In the past, I've had some episodes, had a wingman doing the same thing here, but I brought in the big guns this time. So this time, suck it, Max, Rob, and David, because I got creative. I have the one and only Courtney Miller with me. Hi, Courtney.
I am big guns, apparently. That's awesome.
Yeah, it is.
So what's that? What's that make Rob? Little guns?
Old guns? I don't know.
That's even better.
I'm sorry. I'm gonna be yelled at next week, but whatever. but yeah, so actually, interestingly, history was made last week because Courtney and I were the first two people on Airplane Geeks to actually meet each other in person because I had to go up to Canada.
That's right.
And it was awesome.
So of all the – consider all the possible connections that could be made between the actual Airplane Geeks and – it took us 2 years before we even made one.
But the cool thing is, because I had to go up to Canada for Virgin America's launch party for their new Toronto service. It was actually a very interesting trip. But it was cool because Courtney and I were actually in the same elevator as Richard Branson there for like 15 seconds. He actually has a glow, random fact.
Yes.
You can tell. He's present. So,
it's his hair.
Actually,
it's the reflection off of his hair. It glows.
But anyway, we have some airline news.
Yeah, it was a good time.
Yeah, no, it was fun. It was fun. And I got to spend a half hour with the CEO of Virgin America interviewing him, so that was fun. So actually, I was a little surprised. We actually had some really interesting news this week. I figured maybe going in the holiday weekend we'd see a little calming down, but apparently not. So we had some interesting news from Delta this week, because one thing that I've always been interested in since Northwest and Delta merged, you had a crap load of, honestly, of regional carriers, especially ones that were owned by the airlines. So Delta, at the time of merger, owned Comair, and Northwest had Misaba, which they actually acquired when Misaba went bankrupt, I believe, Court. I'm not sure if I'm remembering correctly, but I think that's how that went down. And then Compass was homegrown. Random fact, Compass was actually started with the old Independence Air operating certificate. But they were homegrown, flying Embraer 175s, and still are. But interestingly, in the Delta owned, so but we had some interesting news on the home owned regional carriers. Misaba has been sold to Pinnacle Airlines for $62 million. Pinnacle is actually a long time Northwest regional carrier. Actually, only with Northwest there for a little while. Operating CRJ-200s, a few CRJ-900s. Pinnacle also owns Colgan now. But then the really interesting one I found was Compass was sold to Transstates, of all people, for $20.5 million. And Transstates is interesting. I don't know, just because – maybe because I don't think of them that often. But I just found
that. TSA slash GoJet slash whatever – are pretty aggressive, and I would consider them a top player in the CPA game now simply because they want to be.
Well, I tell you,
Rick Leach wants to be in the game. He's progressive with it. He's aggressive with it. And I think the Compass thing kind of came out on the numbers right for them. And they didn't want to be left out of the game. I think that's what it is.
Well, yeah, and I agree. And also, to be honest, if I was a leader of Trans States right now is pretty much wed to United. All of GoJet, that's a CRJ 700 operation, that's all with United right now. Right now they have about 20 ERJs or so operating for United as well. And interesting fact, they're actually operating US Airways Express out of Pittsburgh, based in Pittsburgh. It's just still a couple routes left. I think that's only like 3 ERJs, but I just found that interesting. So if I were a leader at TSA, I'd be going, I don't know how this Continental United merger is going to shake out, but at least if I was in that CEO chair, I'd be a little concerned is, well, if I'm only with this one company, I don't know how this merger is going to pan out. I can diversify. Here's an opportunity, especially now with Compass. Those are 70 seaters. I think 76 passengers, I'm not 76 or 86, I'm not sure. But those are the regional jets that are high right now. The 50-seat market is not as great as it was even 5 years ago.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. TSA, now, okay, it's not official, but they've essentially already bet the farm on United with this MRJ. It just essentially is an LOI, right? They haven't actually bought these airplanes for MRJ. So to hedge the bets, yeah, okay, fair enough, kind of, but they're already in, you know, up to their neck, depending on how the deal structure with MRJ to with United. Because it was what, 50? 50 plus 50? So, you know, okay, maybe you've got it gives them another place to perhaps put the airplanes, but I really don't, as far as Delta, yeah, okay, great move. You know, you're diversifying your customer base, essentially, your revenue stream. But as far as bringing on the Embraer aircraft, I don't think that really does much for TSA. I don't think they would have cared one way or another. In fact, I bet they would have preferred those BCRJs to get the fleet commonality benefits with GoJet. That's kind of an orphan fleet.
Fair.
I don't wonder if they're thinking, hey, well, I wonder if we can get out of those and sneak in some MRJs in there. Who knows? But the interesting thing, and Dan, I had pointed this out to you, was kind of the disparity between how much was paid where. So, and this is horrible. I don't have my homework in front of me. But so Pinnacle paid, $62 million for 41 70-seaters, 76 years, excuse me. And Compass paid $20 million for 30?
Yeah. Odd.
Is that right? So now, again, how this deal was structured on the Pinnacle side, we know. And on the Compass side, we pretty sure this is the case as well. Delta retains ownership of the aircraft, and they will be leasing them back. So just to confuse things entirely, Delta owns the aircraft. TSA will be paying a lease to Delta, and TSA will be operating the aircraft, of which Delta will be paying them a capacity purchase agreement fee.
Now, is the sale lease going for both Trans States and for Pinnacle?
Yes, I believe that is the case. Mm-hmm. So, again, now on the Pinnacle side, it's slightly different, at least that I know of. I don't think TSA took a loan, but on the Pinnacle side, what we're hearing is Delta. So just to show how many times the money changes hands in this whole situation, Delta loaned Pinnacle the money to buy Misaba that Delta still owns the leases on. So Pinnacle will pay the lease, and then Delta is paying the CPA fees.
Yeah, that's
kind of twisted arrangement.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it, to me, it almost shows, granted, they're going to be getting the money back and they'll get the interest as well, but it almost seems this is how bad Delta doesn't want to own regional carriers. Hi, we don't want this, here's the money to buy it with.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially they're not getting cash for it because they're providing them the loan. But, you know, look, Delta wouldn't have done it if it didn't work out for them. Besides, and you mentioned it, it gets the it gets the responsibilities of ownership and the mistakes with ownership, I guess, off of Delta's shoulders so that they can – just what they've been doing. Let those airlines deal with it. Let them compete against each other to give Delta the best rates. They can't really do that when it's wholly owned.
Yeah, they're like, oh, wow, Compass is really underperforming. Let's cut our contract with them. Oh, wait, we own them.
Yeah, well, oops. Oops, we own them. Which is interesting because that leaves the orphan now, and that's Comair.
Right. And we've been, and so talk Comair. A little bit more about Comair, why they're left in all alone here.
Well, Comair has 100 aircraft in the fleet. Now, 72 of those are CRJ-200s, so we can basically just count them as zero. But 28 CRJ-700s and CRJ-900s is where the value is. So you're looking at about the size of Compass. So assuming that you get some deal and it's, let's call it $20 million, the problem is that you've got such huge overhead and such a senior pilot and flight attendant group at Comair, not to mention a pilot group who's proven that they're militant enough to go on strike for 89 days. And the costs quickly eat into that $20 million. But imagine, okay, so let's say that we are a imagine for a moment that we are a regional airline in North America. I don't know. Let's call us WiseGuest. So here's SkyWest, and it's a specific example, and I'm not saying that they're the only ones that would be looking at it, but a non-union pilot group, or at least any other airline with a, I guess you could call it, less unionized pilot group than Comair. And you're looking at this asset that is Comair. And if you buy the airline, the pilots and contracts and everything are attached with it. So SkyWest would have to take on these extremely senior Comair pilots into – and it kind of has a toxic relationship with their culture there. Just as an example. And so the value in Comair quickly diminishes to, well, obviously negative, because nobody even offered a buck, you know, for Comair.
Right.
And we're not talking huge money here. I mean, for about what Comair's worth, Compass was a $20 million offer and winning offer, I might add, from TSA. So, we're not talking big bucks here.
Right.
So, sucks.
Yeah, so, and I think this is interesting if you look industry-wide here about the future of wholly owned regional carriers, which I guess, I think slowly are going away. Because look, before, I forget when they were spun off, but Continental used to own ExpressJet, got rid of, you know, don't no longer own them, and Express is independent, and then Continental was able to put more pressure on them with cost, and that's why Express is like, screw you, we're going to try to go our own way, which didn't really work out too well, unfortunately. You have American Eagle, who just got a new CEO, but American said publicly we're interested in maybe possibly spinning them off. You have Horizon, owned by Alaska. They just got a new CEO as well. Not really a whole lot said there, but who knows? Maybe it's always a possibility. And then you have PSA and Piedmont for U.S. Airways, with PSA operating the some CRJ-200s and a few CRJ-700s. And then Piedmont operating the Dash 8s that operate heavily out of LaGuardia and Philly. And actually, that's made me think of a random thing. Pinnacle is getting the Misaba Saab fleet as well, now that I think of it.
Yeah, which is already being phased out. But, you know, Dan, show me one airline that has been wholly owned in the last 10 years that has been better than before it was wholly owned.
Yeah, no.
Is that that? Eagle may be the exception. Because there's really no comparison of what could have happened, because since they're the only operator really for American. But at Delta, clearly, Comair was far better off as a company before Delta owned them. ASA got out from underneath Delta while the getting was good. PSA has really kind of been stuck. Piedmont, which used to be Piedmont and Allegheny, and nothing new's going into those airlines. So, and when you think about it, if you're the mainline carrier, why would you leverage your own balance sheet for regional aircraft, although Delta remains doing that, when you can just let all the little guys fight over it to see who's going to do it for less?
Yeah, exactly. We will continue to watch.
Bitty, interesting.
Yes, thank you for that insight. But yeah, we'll see, especially with Eagles, since American seems to be grooming them for sale. Well, seems to, but Granite has been doing so for a while, but that's the one I'm
most going to say, yeah, they've been grooming them for 10 years.
That's a very fair point, sir, a very fair point. So Frontier, I need to yell at their people because they keep making news announcements, and when you're an intern writing news stories, you get a press release and you go, damn it, I need to write another Frontier story. But I digress. Some interesting route changes. Quick overview, then Court and I will discuss and digress as usual. They're going to start Kansas City, Austin, old Midwest route that got cut a couple years ago, old ExpressJet route that got cut a couple years ago. I think it makes sense. It's not a huge O&D market, but I think when I look at the numbers, there are actually more passengers traveling between the two cities than there are seats that Frontier is throwing in.
I'm sorry. It was Kansas City, Austin?
Yes.
I'm surprised Southwest isn't all over that one.
They have one-stop service.
That seems like a really good route. I mean, that's a good medium-sized O&D market.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's big enough for multiple 737s or if it could be a Southwest. I had to look at the historical schedules. It's what Southwest did when Midwest and ExpressJet were on it. But I think for Midwest perspective is having the ERJ one, well, not the ERJ, the E-170, it just works better than compared to 137-seat aircraft. So I found that interesting. They're cutting Denver Rapid City and old Lynx Market, which, I mean, originally Frontier said, oh, we're going to keep service to all Lynx Markets except Tulsa and Fargo. And, I mean, I'm not surprised they're cutting that one. I'm guessing it was kind of marginal with the Q400 and on the cost side doesn't even looks probably worse than the E-170, making Boise, Denver seasonal, fine, whatever. What I found interesting, actually not interesting yet, restarting Milwaukee Hartford, which used to be flown by Skyway. Remember them, Courtney? Remember the Dorniers? Those were nice.
I did like Skyway.
Yeah.
Those Dorniers were a nice ride.
Yeah. I never flew on one, unfortunately, but they're coming back to Hartford. Now they get the more interesting route stuff. Cutting Milwaukee San Diego. Okay, whatever. It's at least more. Cutting Milwaukee Atlanta.
Cutting the number of flights or just getting rid of it?
Getting rid of it completely. Keeping Denver Atlanta.
Yeah. Well, come on. I mean, AirTran's all over Milwaukee, Atlanta.
Yeah. Well, what I found interesting is,
I mean, you're never going to win that one.
Yeah. Here's my thing. My guess is, the last time I looked at the O&D numbers, granted from the fourth quarter, so a little dated, Midwest was beating, well, now Frontier, but Midwest was beating AirTran, but Delta was beating both of them more. And then
there you go. Yeah.
And also, now that the code share with Frontier / Midwest and Delta is gone, you've lost that feed on that route. So that's what I think. And then when you look at AirTran and Delta, probably with hubs in Atlanta, they can justify a better schedule than Frontier can, and that's more convenient for travelers.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's just all about where you want to put your airplanes.
But interesting on putting the airplanes in places. This September, getting rid of 4 A318s, Frontier is. Not shocking, the A318... Not, I think, Court, you know this better than I, but I think of the A320 family generally the worst on cost performance of the three, yes?
Well, it's a small one, so it would be. Even if it was, the problem is it's the least common, by far the heaviest, and it is what we in the industry refer to as an economic dog.
It actually is a little bit different. Actually, random fact, the A318 tail is a little bit taller than the 319 and the 320 and 321, because I believe, I'm not engineer, but because it's shorter, I believe. And they're getting rid of one E-170, but first half of 2011, six new A320s, better on unit costs, and Frontier has been liking those for some of the longer routes, like I've been seeing them in Washington lately on New York, so that's interesting.
You know, the 100, and we'll call it the 180, well, the 150-seat 320 738s, they've obviously found a nice little sweet spot for that airframe. So that Frontier has been really hanging out in the 319 range does leave open that larger capacity, which, by the way, applies very nicely to Southwest as well.
Mm.
Right, on the Dash 800 side.
Which
Don't forget...
That rumor is perpetual, but seems to have flared up a little bit, at least on airliners.net lately.
Yeah, it'll flare up every once in a while, and I'm sure it's only a matter of time before Southwest does move into that. But, you know, back on the Frontier side, don't forget that they've got, 40 C-Series coming in another 4 years, I believe. Those start to come. And no matter what people say, I think it's quite obvious that those will be a 319 replacement when you look at the retirement date on the 319. And so,
yeah, I think the first 319 comes off. 320s
make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think the first 319 comes off lease in 2015, which meshes pretty well with the first C series delivery, at least I think. So yeah, go with the 320. So, but also speaking of the 319s, interestingly enough, Milwaukee to Boston, New York, and Washington are going all 319.
Well, I mean, you manage your capacity as you have the aluminum available. But look, I think they're doing the right thing with the 320s. I think it's the only aircraft that they need to really bring on in the near term future, because I think they've either solved or have too many of the smaller aircraft between their mix of 170s and 190s and now 145s and God knows what else. In that, just all the leftover airplanes from other CPA agreements, we'll call them.
Yeah.
What leaves it, you know, fleet rationalization, the 320 is a good choice for them.
Yeah. No.
It makes sense to me. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I guess the only thing I thought about the 319 in those business markets is maybe, was it not just demand, but do they want to have a consistent product on every flight? Because right now the E-170 and the 319 products are a bit different.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing, what does a business traveler value more? If you're on a 319, I'd say a little bit more comfortable than an ERJ, but you're going to get live TV. But on the E-170, you're going to get the in-flight internet coming up.
I would actually argue that the 170 is more comfortable than the 319.
Hmm, interesting.
But the live TV makes all the difference. And come on, that again, look, the 320 is a unit cost machine, right? It has the lowest unit costs of their fleet because it's the largest.
Right.
The 319 is a trip cost machine, right? And then you get all the way to the extreme in the E-170, and that is all about trip cost because the chasm on that thing is obscene.
Actually, warning, if you're under 18, stop listening now. It's that bad.
It's that bad. So it's just kind of interesting how they're kind of managing it. I say good for them. You know, I mean, I think we're seeing some good decisions from Frontier. And the 318s, come on, that one was easy.
Yeah, so, I mean, Frontier, the reason I talk about them so much is I think they are the most interesting story in the domestic U.S. market right now. Just because I think they're the only people doing anything really exciting right now, at least on a consistent basis.
Even more interesting than Avatar Airlines?
Yes, Family Airlines, for those who have been following, is now Avatar Airlines. I'm not sure if that changes their prospects for starting or not, but yeah, just to keep...
All the flight attendants have to paint their faces blue and be 6 foot tall.
But yeah, so I mean, Frontier's interesting, and actually in Milwaukee, they're upgrading those routes. They're upgrading Milwaukee-Philly for a mix of E-145s and E-170s, so all E-170. During the winter season, they're getting rid of one connecting bank in Milwaukee. So, I mean, I know not the whole aviation community, the whole airline analysts don't necessarily believe in their branded decision, but I think I like what I'm seeing for them to at least stay competitive, especially in Milwaukee where AirTran just wants to – there's being a bother, whereas in Denver – actually, I heard Brian Bedford speak the other day, and we were able to interview him, is saying that Denver also hyper-competitive, but at least United, Southwest, and Frontier actually acting somewhat rationally, whereas Milwaukee is AirTran's being very belligerent in trying to win that market.
All right, so Dan, I need you to look into your crystal ball. So Denver was the major fighting zone before. Now it's Milwaukee. What's next?
That's really interesting.
Where's the next hotbed?
For Frontier or just for anyone?
Anyone.
Oh, crap. Because that's actually why Frontier has been interesting, because a lot of the airlines have actually been fairly rational in competition right now and adding back capacity.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, let's go through the hubs here. I mean, Denver, we already know. Milwaukee, we'll call it a hub. Well, because that's technically all the airlines have been saying that it's important because it's an extension of Chicago. I think right now New York is actually the interesting hotbed. With this,
my bet.
Well, can I talk about New York? Well, the only reason I say New York is because, well, the only reason I say New York is because you have Delta being really aggressive in trying to win that market with the slot swap and other things. US Airways still a big player, but possibly not with Delta. Continental's always been huge there. But then you have American, kind of the odd man out, now partnering up with JetBlue, which I find really interesting.
Yeah.
So I think you have a lot of efforts from all sides trying to win New York right now.
Well, you couldn't say LA because that's been a fiasco for years.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to tell you, man, I'm really seeing some activity going on in the Miami area.
Really?
Because all of JetBlue, AirTran, and Spirit's growth is out of South Florida into the Caribbean.
Mm.
And they're building up Orlando and Fort Lauderdale, and American is hanging on to Miami. But I think it's only a matter of time before somebody really gives them a push for that, and American starts really fighting back. All of the growth is exploding into the Caribbean and South America out of South Florida.
Yeah,
and before it was only American.
Right, and you see some interest. I actually would be very interested in seeing what would have happened had the Spirit strike actually brought Spirit under.
Well, it would have definitely slowed the process. But that's where I'm interested in seeing, and I don't disagree with you about New York. Of course, Denver and Milwaukee will always be. Who knows? You know, it's always the weirdest cities that pop up. Who knows? It may be like Kansas City.
Well, just the reason I say it had Spirit gone bankrupt is like who would have rushed to grow in Lauderdale quickly to fill that void?
AirTran or JetBlue.
Yeah.
They're the one. JetBlue probably first because they've got the spare aluminum.
Yeah, so, and I mean, you have some interesting competition, not just in the domestic market. I know I heard Aries in Colombia has had a lot of success going into Lauderdale. So it's from both ends.
Yes. Hey, man, if you think Milwaukee's bad, you should see the crap storm that's about to erupt in Colombia between Avianca, Air Republica, and now LAN Colombia. And in the middle of this, you've got Aires and Satena. I mean, what a mess down there. So that is interesting if anybody ever looks outside the industry.
Yeah, and
outside the domestic.
And it's interesting just because, I mean, here I think you can make the argument that in the domestic market there's bloodbath for competition, but it's the U.S. market isn't really growing a whole lot anymore. You're kind of fighting over different pieces of the same pie. Whereas Colombia, yeah, we'll call it mature. But Colombia, like a lot of the South, like Brazil, growing way fast.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Hey, you know what's going to be fun?
What?
Watching you try to edit this down to less than a half an hour.
Yeah. I think now is a good time to call it quits. Thank you for reminding me of my impending pain because Max wants this recording in 4 hours. I'm shuddering at the thought.
You're gonna need it.
Yeah. Okay. So Courtney. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I really kind of bring up the IQ level, I realize.
Mm.
Oh, wait, is it down? I can't remember.
Well, it is nice to have you back in the old saddle, so to speak. So,
anyway. No, it's always fun to be. It's always fun to be here.
Yeah. Anyway, so, guys, this is Dan signing off, and we'll be back to normal next week, I hope. All right, catch you later.
Well, define normal.
Fair point. I could make fun of Rob some more, but I feel I'm already on his... On his list of, you know.
On his list.
Yeah. So, catch you guys later. Bye.
Here I am out in the backyard. It's the 4th of July in the States, and Mr. Max has given us the day off, so all the airplane geeks are goofing off today. Well, at least most of us are. But you know the nice thing about taking the day off every so often, sitting out in the backyard like this, is that it gives me a chance to think about the things that are really important to me. Oh, certainly there's my wonderful bride and my lovely daughter and all the critters that tear up our house all year long. But even more than that, I think about all the things coming down the road in the future that are really important. Like AirVenture 2010. Oh my gosh, it's only 3 weeks away. I can't believe it. 3 weeks away, And the largest air show in the world takes place in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, just a few hours north of me here in Chicago. I mean, in 1 week, there will probably be 600,000 people through that airport. On average, there are 10,000 airplanes parked on the grounds. It's unbelievable. So if you're even thinking about stopping by at AirVenture this year, make sure you do. So this year at AirVenture 2010, we're going to have something very, very special. On July the 27th, that's a Tuesday afternoon, if you're on the AirVenture grounds, make sure you find your way to the Forum Pavilions. Those are north of the Control Tower, north of the big Honda Pavilion. They're little buildings. They're numbered 1 through 10, I believe. And unfortunately, we're not sure which one we're going to be in yet. But from 4 until 5:30 on Tuesday, July 27th, come on out. We're going to have some of the Jetwine gang there. We're going to have some of the... What's that other show called? Oh, right, the Airplane Geeks. We're going to have some of the Airplane Geekers there. I'm going to be there. Dan Webb's going to be there. We think we might have David. Unfortunately, we had to leave Max at home next year. And, yes, for those of you that were hoping to meet Steve and Grant, we couldn't come up with quite enough money to fund their boat trip from Australia back up to Oshkosh. But maybe next year. So help us start that fund. But listen, we're also going to have John Ostrower, flight blogger, is going to be there. We're going to have Rod Rakick from My Transponder, and a bunch of his folks are going to be there. And you know what? This year we're going to try something new. We're not going to just talk about social media. We're going to talk about practical aspects of social media. We're going to talk about how we can actually solve some of the collective problems that we have in our aviation industry using this incredible network that we've all put together in the last few years on Twitter, on Facebook, on our blogs, on our podcasts. And who knows, there might just be a few really interesting giveaways like more Jetwine buttons. Everyone needs one of those. And on top of it, we're going to meet some brand new friends. So thank you so much to all the listeners here on Airplane Geeks who have taken the time to email us and tell us that they're going to be at AirVenture and want to connect with us. We want to connect with you as well. So remember, July the 27th, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we'll be looking for you. Of course, we'll see you back here next week when we have our regular Airplane Geek show. And until then, I'm Rob Mark for Jetwine.com and the Airplane Geeks. See you at AirVenture.
Hey, did you see that? That's not even funny. That stupid squirrel threw something at me. He could have killed me.
Maybe this on-location recording's not all it's cooked up to be. See you next week.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Now, Mr. McHaren, Grant, why do you think you keep having these relapses into Kiwidom?
I don't know, cuz.
No. It should be, I don't know, mate. Try and say that for me.
I think I need some more chops.
No, Grant, please try and say billabong.
Billabong.
No, billabong.
Billabong.
Good, we're making some progress here, Grant. Now let's try Waltzing Matilda.
Jumbuck, sheep, yes.
Yes, keep going. Promising. Barbecue. Think of a barbecue. No. Barbecue. Barbie. Think Barbie.
Oh, Barbie.
Think this Melbourne is... Bitter.
Ooh.
Barbie. Oh. Melbourne Bitter.
Crack a tube, mate. Oh.
Yes, oh. Keep going. Picture yourself at a football match.
All blacks.
No. Australian rules football, Grant. Think of the oval ball. Australian rules. Collingwood.
Come on, Collingwood!
Collingwood. Melbourne Bitter.
Barbie. Crack a tube. Oh, chuck us another one, Bruce.
Very good. Mr. Fisher, I think you can take him home now.
Do I have to?
Please, would you?
Oh, thanks very much, Doc. You know what? I think Rob Mark was right after all. Grant did need a psychiatrist.
Whoa, I'm cured. It's a miracle. Yay! Hey, does this mean I'm fully cured? I'm back to normal again?
Well, insofar as normal goes for you, Grant, I'm sure we've probably got a lot more work to do.
Okay. Well, you know, maybe we should try and cement the Aussieisms by reading through some news. Hey, look, there's a whole lot of stuff here. Like, remember we were talking the other day about those stupid cockpit laws that would prevent a pilot from deadheading and make the captain responsible for locking the doors? Looks like they got kicked out. Yay! Again.
Yes, it looks like there's been a move in the Australian Senate to quash that by the an independent senator by the name of Nick Xenophon. He's a senator from South Australia, and he does have a bit of a history, although this was a man who was elected on, funnily enough, an anti-gambling platform.
Yeah, well, he worked for us this time. I'm willing to say thanks, Nick.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how it goes. Sometimes with these independent senators, it can be a good thing and it can be a bad thing when they're a sort of a single-issue guy. But this Nick Xenophon, on many issues in Australian politics, is actually, I think he's done a pretty reasonable job. In this case, he's going into bat for the pilots and trying to overturn, as you said, Grant, this ridiculous law that the government was trying to put up, which would basically prevent even pilots flying dead sectors from being in the cockpit of an aircraft. Just totally ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, indeed. I mean, that's the question. How can a pilot who is responsible for an aircraft one moment and is now deadheading suddenly be a security issue?
And, of course, if any of our Airplane Geeks listeners have been keeping an eye in any form lately on Australian politics, you'll know that there's been lots of changes over the last couple of weeks. Although we have not had a change of government, we've had a change of Prime Minister, such as the strange workings of the British Westminster political system that we have here. So there's been a lot of changes in government. They're talking about a lot of changes in attitudes on a lot of issues. I'm a little bit sceptical, as always, about anything a politician tells us, but we'll see what happens. So a really interesting time. I really hope, Grant, that amongst the changes that we might get, that this one will be one of them.
Yeah, hopefully they'll never bring it up again. But yep. The other piece of quick news we got here is that Qantas are saying that business class is making a return. It may be picking up for them, but I'll bet it's going to be a lot lower than it was before. I don't think it's ever going to get back to those heyday levels before the GFC. But yeah, of course, naturally, Qantas would say that things are getting better. They're coming up on the end of financial year and they're wanting to pump out some good information.
Yeah, perhaps trying to come up with some sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, Grant. But as we've mentioned quite a few episodes back now, Qantas is investing something in the region of about $400 million in removing first class from, just about all of their fleet.
Yep.
And replacing some of that, at least in part, with business and premium economy seating. So, yeah, well, they've got a vested interest in talking it up.
Indeed. But they Qantas must be spewing a bit at the moment, because Don John Borchetti, from who's now with Virgin Blue, is busy recruiting Qantas staff.
A hardly surprising move there too, Grant. Of course, John Borghetti, ex-Qantas executive, and some of the things we've been hearing about his attitudes to not getting a top job at Qantas, he's out there to make Qantas pay. And now that he's at the reins of Virgin Blue, it looks like he's going for broke, and he's starting to headhunt as many of the top people there as he can get.
Yeah, no, he's bringing in people who have recently left and a few that were currently there when he took them. But it's interesting, he's started restructuring and merging V Australia and Virgin Blue, and it looks very like they must have some sort of agreement out of Singapore, either that or else they're going to go and rebrand everything V Australia. They're streamlining and restructuring, bringing together both operations to have a common management group. So all the indications are that it's going to be the one group, as the rumours have led to. We're just waiting to find out what the name's going to be, whether they've been able to twist Singapore Airlines' arm to allow Virgin Australia to fly, or whether it's all just going to be V Australia.
So now, Grant, I've always found V Australia to be kind of an awkward name, and I understand the reasons why they had to choose that sort of a name. Let's have a bit of a straw poll here. What do you think, mate? What do you reckon sounds better? We were talking about this before we started recording, and perhaps our Airplane Geeks listeners could even offer an opinion on the website, on the feedback forum there. Virgin Pacific or Virgin Australia? Which one do you think sounds better? What do you reckon, Grant?
I reckon it's going to be Virgin Australia. It rolls better in terms of Virgin Atlantic, Virgin America, Virgin Australia. It may be Virgin on the ridiculous, but it just keeps things going. I had to do it.
Oh, dear. I don't think you're fully cured after all.
Well, yeah, I'm not cured of everything, mate. I reckon it'll be Virgin Australia, because then they can have the call sign VOz, which is how most people refer to as V Australia, as VOz, and which is way better than the current Virgin Blue airline code of DJ.
Yeah, all the way with DJ. But yeah, just interesting. I kind of think, Grant, that Virgin Pacific rolls off the tongue a bit better, and after all, they do have Virgin Atlantic, so there is that to sort of think of too. I suppose they could call themselves VPAC or something to the air traffic controllers.
Yeah, well, it's being called GoCat.
Yes, or, go occasionally cat.
Yes. For those who don't know, Go Cat is the name of a cat food down here, and that's the call sign that all the Tiger Airlines aircraft go as.
Well, Grant, speaking of our favourite discount carrier, Tiger Airways.
No, Steve. We need to change the sound effect for Tiger. We have to use the sound that you hear whenever a Tiger Airways aircraft goes overhead. That's it.
That would be the one. Yes, any wonder they're making a profit, Grant. New charges on the way for this high-class airline.
That's right. Currently, you have to pay $10 if you want to check in online, but now they're actually introducing a $15 or more check-in fee at the gate. If you go and queue at the airport to check in, you'll pay more as a check-in fee than if you do it online. And if paying to queue wasn't enough, they're also lifting their luggage charges. First 15 kilos is $20 instead of $15, and up to 25 kilos will set you back $50 instead of $45. So most people find it pretty hard to pack in anything under 20 kilos. So immediately your luggage fees are going to be quite high. And the sports equipment charge has doubled and gone up to $60. So what this means is that where Tiger may appear to have a airfare that's a little cheaper than Virgin Blue or Qantas, once you add the check-in fee, the baggage fee, and all the other fees, it's going to cost you a lot more.
I'll tell you what, if our good friend Senator Xenophon wanted to do something, you know, really positive for air travel, he could introduce some sort of bill to outlaw this ridiculous idea that they can put extra fees on above the base fee. They should just have to advertise it as, this is what it'll cost you to take this seat all up, not all these extra things. It's just ridiculous. And the thing that really annoys me about this is they're still charging you if you do it online. Well, you're doing it online to save them having to pay some poor human to do it for you, so therefore you're saving the money and they're charging you for the privilege.
Well, and here's one more little twist on it. Let's say you do it online. You book your ticket online, you check in online, you print out your boarding pass online. Where is the first time you see the humans? When you go through security, when's the next time you see the humans? At the gate. Now, when does anyone check your ID to confirm your name is the same as what's on the boarding pass and ticket? You don't. So how long do you think until our take any hit that he can transport minister Albanese decides that, oh, this is a security hole, and that all these swift cool self check-in kiosks and internet check-in print out your boarding pass things are declared insecure?
Yep. And obviously Crawford Ricks, who's the new managing director of Tiger Airways this week, well, he says that Tiger Airlines wanted to, and I quote, reward travelers who use web check-in with our lowest fares. Well, yeah, using web check-in, but like I've said before, they're not really rewarding them, they're just taxing them less.
Yeah, well, that's a reward. You don't get hit on the head as hard.
Yes, well, we should all reward ourselves and fly with somebody else. That's my opinion.
Indeed, and that's what I've been saying to people. If you don't like it, go pay the extra and then tell the airline that you didn't fly with them, even though you could have saved $50, because you don't agree with them. You know, we're the cause of this problem. We, the passengers, who have demanded the cheapest fares ever, are getting what we asked for, and we don't like it.
Yep. Well, Grant, speaking of passengers who got what they asked for, let's have our Dropkick of the Week segment.
Ooh, we haven't done that for a while, have we?
We haven't. Passenger fined $4,000 for a bomb hoax recently aboard a Jetstar aircraft.
That's right. Apparently, a Cairns man had arrived on a Jetstar aircraft and was, in his opinion, the passengers weren't moving faster, wanted to get them to move a little quicker, and said that there was a bomb on board. Most people didn't take this too kindly. He was picked up by the federal police and, of course, then interviewed. I love the way they say that.
Yes, assisting them with their inquiries, I believe.
Yes. But yes, he then said that actually it was a hoax, and the judges said that he was, to quote a previous Ausdesk, very naughty.
Yes, very naughty.
And he's copped a $4,000 fine.
Well, there you go, $4,000, and gee whiz, lucky he's not American, Grant, because the way the Aussie dollar is going, it would, how much would that be? About $2,000 US.
Yeah, well, you know, still more than he can afford.
We do talk a lot about security theatre, but all that aside, going on and doing that, when there's been so many cases, you know, in the past that have been publicised like this, where people have thought they're making a joke and end up in the clink, you'd think people would use their brains, but then again, what am I thinking?
The only thing common about common sense is it doesn't exist.
Sense is not common.
No.
Okay, Grant, now we've just escaped to New Zealand finally, and of course, you know, you're over there and nearly in the clink yourself until I busted you out, but at the risk of a relapse, let's have one more story about our friends over at Air New Zealand.
Air New Zealand, cuz? Nah, just kidding.
No!
Had you going. Yeah, that's right. Some of you may remember that a year ago or so, there was a Air New Zealand A320 that was doing a checkout flight over in France. It had been leased to a German airline, and as part of the handover, it had been repainted. Some German pilots were at the control controls, and a few Kiwi engineers and pilots were on board when it fell out of the sky at low level and crashed, taking the life of, I think it was all seven who were on board. What's come up is that, yes, post-painting, there is a chance they may have actually painted over some of the static ports. There is some indication that that was the case, but no charges are being laid because, according to one of the prosecution groups in France, it was pilot error. They're saying that the pilots were doing maneuvers at low level that they shouldn't have been doing, and a combination of that and the impact of having the aircraft freshly painted led to the accident.
Yeah, so the interesting part here is that they're saying it's unlikely that any criminal action will be aimed at Air New Zealand, so it looks like this will just end up being a stalemate based on what you've said there, Grant. I remember watching an episode of Air Crash Investigation, or one of those sorts of shows, talking about I think it was a 757 once it took off from South America, where they had been washing the aircraft and had put tape across the static vents on this particular aircraft and forgot to remove it afterwards. So that aircraft took off at night time and ended up crashing into the ocean after getting all sorts of erroneous readings. So sounds like there could have been a similar sort of situation here, which would be very unfortunate. You would think under any sort of quality control system that that sort of stuff would be inspected before the aircraft left the ground.
Yeah, there's that aspect, and there's also the aspect that apparently the German pilots flying the plane had not received specific training for the flight they had taken, so they hadn't gone through and done a full pre-briefing of everything they'd do. So a combination of factors, once again, the holes and the cheese lined up. But I haven't seen a lot of information, mind you, I haven't really gone hunting at this stage, but I haven't seen a lot of information on the aspect of being repainted and whether that was actually some static ports that were covered and whether that may have contributed to it. But I may have to try and dig up the reports. But I think it's all going to come down to a pair of insurance companies arguing over who gets to pay for what.
Oh, God, so it'll be stuck in the court for years to come, Grant. That'll give us something to talk about on Ausdesk 300, probably.
Oh, very likely, mate.
Yeah. Well, anyway, folks, that's about everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk Report. We do realise, of course, that this is a completely pre-recorded episode, being that it's the 4th of July weekend. So to all our American listeners, a very happy 4th of July to you all, and we hope that you've had a wonderful long weekend. And Grant, I think they have a long weekend for 4th of July, don't they?
I'm pretty sure they do. Whether the 4th is a weekend or not, they get that extra time off. It's been a while since I lived in the US, but I do seem to remember 4th of July being a pretty big party time.
Of course, our equivalent of that is January 26th, and that's Australia Day. We have a public holiday for that, but then again, this is Australia, and we'd have a public holiday for anything.
Oh, any excuse to fire up the barbie, crack a tube, have a beer.
Absolutely. And folks, we hope you've enjoyed the themed Ausdesks that we've had going the last 4 weeks. We're probably going to give that a rest for a while, because whilst they're fun to get produced, they do take a lot of work. I'm a bit tired, and my sound effects machine is a bit tired as well. So,
Do you mean we're going to have to unchain you from the production rig?
Yes, I need to go and reintroduce myself to my family. So.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, we will put our heads together in the next the coming months and hopefully come up with something that you'll find entertaining. And well, if we find it entertaining, and we hope you do as well. So until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
Cheers, folks.
Have you ever dreamed of taking to the skies in your very own airplane? You can get your chance and support a great aviation organization at the same time. The 1940 Air Terminal Museum at Hobby Airport in Houston, Texas is selling raffle tickets to give away a vintage Cessna. For more information, visit www.1940airterminal.org.
What you are about to hear are interviews done at Mid-Atlantic Air Museum's World War II Commemorative Weekend. This air show, please note my hands doing air quotes, takes place at Reading Regional Airport the first weekend in June every year. Whatever Friday, Saturday, and Sunday is closest to June 6th. Strictly focusing on World War II, the airfield gets invaded by reenactors of Germans, Americans, Italians, Japanese, Marines. In a quick glimpse, you might see Churchill walking next to an Africa corpsman, a Marine chatting up with a young lady in cork heels, fishnet stockings, and a hairnet. There is also a huge group of individuals who dress in vintage 40s clothing representing the home front. Packards and cars run up and down the streets. Jeeps of all sorts run up and down the field, which is covered in tents. There's a P-40E, an F-4U-1 Corsair, a pair of B-17s, the only flying Lancaster bomber in North America, B-25s, DC-3s, and no less than 5 P-51 Mustangs. Since this is an audio podcast, here's a slice of World War II weekend. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope I caught what a slice of the weekend is all about, heroes and people.
Association president, and we're standing in front of, or I should say we're sitting in front of, the Spirit of Freedom, a C-54. Timothy, do you want to tell us a little bit about the airplane?
Yes, I'd be delighted to. This particular C-54 I found in Canada in 1992. I'd been looking for an airplane for 4 years, and when was unable to find one that might be suitable and available for our use. But I received a telephone call. There was one parked in Toronto, Canada. This turned out to be the airplane. I was able to make a purchase offer to the owner, Mr. Ed Johns, who'd been using the airplane to carry auto parts out of Toronto, Canada. And after a few years of hard work, we were able to get it in operation in 1994. This particular airplane was built for the U.S. Army Air Force in 1945. It stayed in the Air Force inventory for only 6 months, was turned over to the U.S. Navy. It stayed with the U.S. Navy from 1945 all the way to 1973. The last several years in service, it actually was with the U.S. Marine Corps, which is part of the Navy. Went into storage for 3 years. Mr. Ed Johns got it out of there and carried auto parts. And in 1991, he parked the airplane in Canada. We made an offer in 1992 and acquired the airplane. It has about 27,000 hours of flying. To this date, we've put 1,350 hours on the airplane in our mission, which is quite a lot to say, considering we really began our operation in 94 flying the airplane.
And what exactly is the mission of the airplane?
Our mission is to preserve the history of the Berlin Airlift, of which 330 Douglas C-54s participated, and to honor the veterans who participated in that mission, which was in 1948-1949. We have equipped the airplane with an exhibit in a museum used for educational purposes. And our job is to improve on that so when our visitors come aboard, they can learn what the Berlin Airlift was all about.
And how does the C-54 fly?
I would imagine someone flying today's modern airplanes would find it difficult to fly. However, in its day, in 1945, you got to realize this was a Cadillac of the skies. And compared to a bomber or some other airplanes of that era, this is a very nice airplane to fly. I savor every second flying it.
Let's talk a little bit more about what the airplane represents. How did you get affiliated with Operation Vittles and the history behind the Berlin Airlift?
You know, I get that question answered a lot. And my standard answer, it had to be something God put there because I served my time during the Vietnam era. I'm a U.S. Army veteran. Nothing to do with airplanes or the airlift other than I was in Army aviation. But I can recall at the age of 6 years old looking at a Life magazine, and this would have been around 1950. Probably what I was reading was a cleanup article about the Berlin Airlift, which came to a halt in they flew all the way till the end of September 1949. They flew to the end of September 1949 before they stopped the airlift. So what I was reading at that young age had to do something with the airlift, but I was just fascinated with the Douglas C-54 from then on. And as I got older and realized what the airlift was about, I became a champion of the Berlin Airlift. So it had to have begun years and years ago. As I got older, I realized how nice it would be to have an educational display inside of a C-54. And this is my dream come true, what you're looking at here at Reading.
But, folks, this is not his only or the organization's only airplane. You want to tell us about the other one that you're working on restoring?
Yes, I guess, you know, we all carry different values in life, you know. Sometimes they don't show up right away. My love of the Berlin Airlift and fascinated with the statistics that they endured in order to preserve freedom in Berlin. That comes from my history part of my life and my desire to create something that would be lasting and historical. However, our C-97-1 was used in the airlift. And the part of me that's a pilot and a mechanic and the challenge of getting that airplane up and running, that is why I'm looking into that airplane, because it's a great challenge. One was used in the Berlin airlift. I would like to extend the Berlin airlift history into the Cold War era, where the C-97 became known for the first tanker manufactured as a tanker to air-to-air refuel airplanes. Appropriately, during that era, the Cold War, we're naming our airplane the Angel of Deliverance for its deliverance of fuel to thirsty jet fighters and bombers, to delivery of goods as a cargo airplane in the straight C-97 cargo version. Now, our airplane was actually manufactured as a tanker in 1952. However, since then, it's been converted back to a cargo airplane with all the refueling gear and apparatus taking off. And it's ideal for us because our Cold War Museum, it's a perfect platform for a Cold War Museum, at which we'll begin with Berlin airlift history and go all the way through until the lifting of the Berlin Wall in 1989.
So does that mean that you will eventually try to get a KC-135 to go with the collection?
No. The only other airplane we might get is a C-47. And those three airplanes were all used in the Berlin airlift. Now, looking at the C-97, because it was introduced late in the airlift, the one that they had taken over, there was a dual purpose there. One, it was brought into the lift because of its heavy lift capability, 40,000 pounds versus the 20,000 of the C-54. But Boeing wanted to see how it would endure under actual under-fire type conditions flying the Berlin airlift. It came in late in the lift. The blockade was lifted May 12th. It only arrived in Berlin on May 4th. Okay? It actually arrived May 2nd. It flew its first mission on May 4th, but in a week's time, it carried a tremendous amount of tonnage all by itself. But after the blockade was lifted, the pressure was off, and they took the airplane back home. But if the airlift had continued into the 1950s, the plan was to pull all the C-54s out and introduce a half number of C-97s and the new developed C-124 that was developed at the same time.
Well, I know you're incredibly busy, but tell us a little bit about the Berlin Airlift Historical Foundation and where we can find you online, and a little bit more that if anyone else wants to find some more interest in the Berlin Airlift and the C-54 and the C-97, kind of partial to that. The color scheme on that one, folks, is stunning. So give us a little more information about the foundation, Timothy.
All righty. Then I'll tell you a little bit about that color scheme that's on the C-97. Yeah, the Berlin Airlift Historical Foundation, we are a tax-exempt nonprofit organization. Our website is www.spiritoffreedom.org. Tell you about the C-54 Spirit of Freedom and the C-97 Angel of Deliverance. But we have a supporting membership across the country. We're about 600 strong right now. Even members in Europe and Hawaii. And our goal is to constantly improve our mission, constantly improve the interior of the airplane. We're spread out quite a bit across the country. But it has been very exciting to help this organization grow. We have a lot of plans for improving the interior of the C-54 to something even better than we have now. Better ways to communicate with younger people. So that's all in the future that we're looking forward to. Now, that paint scheme on the C-97, when you, if you visit the website, spiritoffreedom.org, you'll see that paint scheme. It looks like an Indian headdress on the front of the airplane. Now, that came about by the 1st Strategic Support Squadron, part of Air Force history that a lot of people aren't aware of. There was a 1st Strategic Support Squadron, then they developed the 2nd Strategic Support Squadron. Now you ask, well, what is that all about? Well, what that was, it was the Air Transport Division of the Strategic Air Command. And this was the cargo-carrying aspect of the Strategic Air Command. That paint scheme on our airplane is from the 1st Strategic Support Squadron. There was only 10 airplanes painted that way of C-97s. However, you will see other airplanes. You will see other airplanes painted that way. C-124, C-54s, they carry that headdress marking. That's the 1st Strategic Support Squadron emblem. It's very unusual to see an airplane with that on it.
Well, Timothy, thank you so much. Like I said, you've got a great mission. From a history standpoint, it's an important part of the Cold War history and U.S. transport history. And anybody who doesn't know about Operation Vittles and candy bombers needs to do some research on it. And appreciate you taking the time.
I would like to add that Gail Halverson, the Berlin candy bomber, hearing you mention his name, he still flies with us. He's 90 years old, but he looks like a young 90-year-old. You know, he actually acts like a 60-year-old. But I'm very honored to be able to share the cockpit with Gail Halverson. We are scheduled in September of this year, 2010, to be in Wise, Virginia for a candy drop. He's taking most of the year off to visit his grandkids and great-grandkids. But in 1998, when I took the airplane to Europe, Gail was my co-pilot. And since then, we've done many candy drops together around the country. Him not only flying with us, but other people as well have dropped candy with Gail. So for me, it's just a God-sent gift that I can rub elbows with a living hero that's still with us.
Well, again, thank you very much for taking the time.
Very good.
This is David Vanderhoof, and I'm here with Craig Wadsworth, standing in front of a beautiful Beech 18. Craig, you want to talk about your airplane?
Thanks. We've got a 1941 vintage. It was actually built originally as an AT-11 by Beech Aircraft in Wichita, Kansas. This particular airplane spent its career during the war in the Midwest and Texas doing bombardier navigator training. And then after the war, it was part of the large project that Beechcraft did to take all these AT-11s and AT-7s back to the standard twin Beech configuration. And then after that, where the original nose was put back on and the bomb racks were taken out, it was flown by the Navy up to through 1952 when it was let out of the service. At that point, it was actually transferred to the Civil Air Patrol and then finally into the civilian market, where it was a skydiving aircraft. It was also an aerial sprayer. We got the airplane in 1988 and have been restoring it and have it back on the air show circuit. Right now, it's painted as a Marine SNB as a nod to the two gentlemen who made its acquisition possible into our museum. The 1941 Historical Aircraft Group is based in Geneseo. Our website is 1941hag.org. And our air show is coming up the second week in July. We're expecting a large turnout of World War II predominantly, but also some current military. We're going to have the F-16 Heritage Flight, the F-15 Demo Team, as well as a J-Model C-130 on the ground at Geneseo. And we'll have about 100 to perhaps 120 aircraft. Check out our website, and hopefully we'll see you there. Thanks a lot.
This is David Vanderhoof, the Airplane Geeks historian, and I'm here with Colonel Clarence Bud Anderson, World War II vet and P-51 pilot. Good afternoon, Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good. A couple of real quick questions that I've been dying to know. One is, what was the better aircraft, the P-51B or the P-51D?
Well, I liked them both. The B was a favorite because I did a whole tour in a B. And I shot down more airplanes in a B than I did with a D. But the D represents my total tour, and so I liked them both. When I say I liked them both, I liked the B with the Malcolm hood because that gave you the great visibility, and it was almost as good as the classic D model.
Oh, you know what?
With that bubble canopy, and so I don't know. I loved them both.
Yeah, you better ask. Okay, the next question would be, where did the name Old Crow come from?
Well, obviously, I've been asked that many times, so I have a prepared statement for you. I tell my non-drinking friends that it's named after the most intelligent bird that flies in the sky, the crow. And that's true. The crow is considered very, very intelligent. But my drinking buddies all know it's named after that good old Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey. Now, my wife Ellie, best thing that ever happened to me, we're on our 66th year of marriage. She likes to kid around. She says, you know, most guys name their airplane after their sweetheart or their wife. What do they think's going on here?
Yeah, like your wingman, General Yeager, named it after his love of his life. Tell me a little bit, we'll go a little bit further down in your history. Tell me a little bit about flying the F-105.
The F-105?
Yeah.
Well, the F-105 was misnamed. It should have been the B-105. It was a bomber. It was a great airplane for the job. It was a very survivable airplane and could fly very fast low at low altitude. I enjoyed flying it, but it's not an aerial combat airplane.
Yeah, what was that transition like, flying World War II air-to-air to delivering bombs over North Vietnam?
Well, I didn't deliver any bombs in North Vietnam. We were all in Laos and on the Ho Chi Minh Trail late in the war. Well, it's amazing. I used machine guns and dropped iron bombs in World War II. And in Vietnam, I did the same thing. But I did it in a jet airplane, so I was going a hell of a lot faster. And, of course, we had the Vulcan cannon, which really spits out the ammo.
What's your favorite airplane to fly?
I got three favorites. P-51, because it got me through the war. F-86 is a beautiful airplane. It flies very well. And then the later airplanes are really nice because they're flown by computers, and you can shape the flying characteristics how you want them. So all the new fighters are very nice to fly. And I've flown a F-16 in the back, and I've flown a F-15 in the front seat. F-15 is a marvelous airplane to fly.
Sounds like you got quite a repertoire. Have you flown any civilian in your military life?
I'm sorry.
Civilian. Have you flown anything? What have you flown outside of your military career?
Oh, lots of stuff. Well, I've flown 300 different kinds of airplanes, something like that. I don't really know how many.
Must be one lengthy logbook.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, you're incredibly busy. I really appreciate you taking the time, and you've always been one of my heroes. I've had Old Crow sitting on my modeling bench for years, so I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me.
All right, thank you.
I'm here with General Frederick Boots Blees, an F-86 pilot in the Korean War. General Blees, could you tell me a little bit about your career in Korea?
Yeah, I had two tours in Korea. I was a West Point graduate and got out too late to get into the big war. So when Korea came along, I dumped the F-80 and the F-86 and took a P-51 assignment and went to Korea. I flew, this was on my first tour. I flew 67 missions in a P-51, and then I had 1,000 hours in the F-80, so they transferred me up to another F-80 outfit, and I finished up there through the last 35 missions of my tour. Went back to the States. About 4 months later, the MiGs and the F-86s are tangling. I couldn't stand it. I'd have volunteered for another tour in Korea. And I got into the F-86 and A-56 outfit with the 4th Group. And that was, it was an amazing thing in one way. And that while I was in the States, every day in the paper I'm reading about all these fights between the MiGs and the 86s. And I get the feeling that if I can get over there, every day I've got an opportunity to either get shot down or to shoot somebody else down. And it didn't work out that way. I saw a MiG on my second mission, flying with Colonel McHuron. And I saw, the next MiG I saw was on my 48th mission. I shot one down. By the time I had 85 missions, I had 3 kills and 5 sightings. I mean, I couldn't believe what was going on. So I volunteered. I got another one. Around the early 90s, and I wasn't going to leave there until I got my 5th one. So I volunteered for another 25 missions, and I got 5 more during that time.
And what was your opinion of the F-86? It sounds like it was a love at first sight.
Yeah, it was really. I loved it. I've got about 3,500 hours in it by now. But the good, honest airplane would do whatever you were capable of making it do. I loved it.
And where did your career take you after the F-86s?
Well, after the F-86s, I went back to the training command. They sent me back to the training command. They had 6 training squadrons at Nellis. And that's when I wrote my little training manual, No Guts, No Glory. The Air Force used that for 23 years. And so they must have liked something about it. I stayed there for a while, and then I went, they sent me, I was there about 2 years, I guess, and then they sent me down to Texas as a chief of the fighter division, the crew training Air Force. And I had that for a while, and then about a year later, they transferred me to Germany, and I went to the fighter wing there at Bitburg. And I was there for about 4 months. And then the squadron commander up in Schusterberg, Holland, got in some trouble. And I got appointed as the squadron commander and the base commander at Schusterberg, Holland. I did that for about 3 years.
Well, you got a lot of autographs to sign today, but I appreciate you taking the time with us. Thank you very much, and most of all, thank you very much for your service.
Well, thank you. That was like a vacation to me. It's what I'd wanted to do my whole life. And I wanted to be a fighter pilot from the time I was about 10 years old. So it was just something that I really wanted to do and enjoyed every minute of it. Thank you.
Folks, hi. This is David Vanderhoof. I'm now in the civilian part of Mid-Atlantic Air Museum under a beautiful Fairchild in Civil Air Patrol marks with Sean. Sean is the owner of this stunning red aircraft. So you want to tell me a little bit about it?
Sure. This is a 1940 Fairchild 24, and we fly in the colors of Civil Air Patrol Coastal Patrol Base 2 out of Rehoboth, Delaware.
And what's the history behind the airplane?
The actual airplane, we believe, was the last of 23 in a block bought by the Civil Aeronautics Association, and it was out west as a airways inspection airplane, actually originally delivered on floats. Then the War Plants Division acquired the aircraft at the beginning of the war, and it became an instrument instruction airplane for Southwestern Airways, which was a large flight school in the Southwest, had almost 2,000 flight instructors, and they taught Army Air Corps pilots. So this was an instrument trainer during the war. Basically, from then on, it was just in civilian hands.
And the way it's set up right now, what would his role been in flying for the CAP in World War II?
basically, when war broke out, the United States was totally unprepared. There were literally six Navy destroyers to defend the East Coast from the onslaught of the U-boats. Civil Air Patrol was born literally 1 week before Pearl Harbor, just by accident, December 1st, 1941. And the first job that they were given was to set up coastal patrol bases to hunt for German submarines, because our U.S. military was too weak to do it at the time. So a 90-day experiment was started, and bases were set up at Atlantic City, Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, and Lantana, Florida. They immediately proved their worth when, on the very first patrol out of Rehoboth, Delaware, a submarine was sighted on the surface by a CAP aircraft about to shell a passing freighter. The presence, just the presence, of the unarmed reconnaissance aircraft caused the sub to crash dive, saving the freighter from being sunk. So immediately, CAP proved its worth just by being the eyes of the home skies, so to speak.
And what's your association with the aircraft?
My wife and I bought the airplane 4 years ago, and I've been in Civil Air Patrol since I was 15, about 30-some years ago. And so I grew up with the stories of our CAP subchasers, you know, when I was a teenager, and that just absolutely fascinated me. So when we were looking for an airplane, my wife fell in love with the type, and so we located one and decided to fly it around in honor of the Civil Air Patrol veterans. During the war, CAP sighted 173 submarines and reported them. It attacked 57, because after a few months of the unarmed reconnaissance, we were ordered by Hap Arnold to arm the airplanes so they would carry 100-pound bombs on smaller planes like ours and the Stinson 10A, and then larger planes like the Stinson Reliance and Grumman Widgeons and such actually carried 250-pound depth charges. So they sighted 173 subs, attacked 57 of them, and were credited with sinking two.
Very cool. And what's she like to fly? You got to go around the field pattern quite a few times today, but she's stunning in the air. What's she like to fly?
This is a real gentleman's airplane. She flies like a dream. We've got a red leather interior in her, roll-down windows. If you're going to go to war in style. And it just floats through the turbulence. It doesn't jerk. It's got a lovely-sounding engine and nice, cushy landing gear. So she is just a dream to fly.
Well, thank you for taking the time. It's a beautiful airplane. And thank you for commemorating the CAP and the important role that the our home front played during World War II.
Thank you very much.
David Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian reporter at Mid-Atlantic Air Museum's World War II weekend. And I'm sitting, taking a little bit of shade under this 85-degree heat with Mike Streeter. Mike, you want to tell me about the airplane?
Sure. It's a 1943 Taylor Craft L2 Model M.
And what did this do in World War II?
Well, it was L stood for liaison, and they did a variety of things, but they were originally designed as artillery spotters. And they did that, as well as lugged the brass around, carried mail, paychecks, things like that.
Everything the fighter guys didn't want to do, right?
Exactly right. The dirty little jobs.
Your L2 has some interesting nose art. You want to tell me about it?
Well, sure. The nose art, name of the airplane is called IP. And on one side, the letters IP are on there. And that IP is there for the name of IP, standing for initial point, which was used in bombers. The nose art on the left side of the airplane was off of a B-17 in Germany, late 1944. And a very good friend of mine was the Jim Cannon was the captain of IP, the 17. Jim has since passed away. His widow's still with us. Jim had told me about the nose art, that was the only airplane he had flown during the war. And he flew from December 7th. He was one of the 12 B-17s that flew into Pearl Harbor on that day, December 7th. He was a co-pilot at that point. But when he was over in Europe, he had this 117 that he got to paint the nose art on. That nose art, he thought of on December 7th, when they landed the 12 B-17s at a grass strip on Oahu, they deplaned and they ran over to some drainage ditches beside the runway that the planes were on. And just then, the second wave of the Japanese attacked. They were in the ditch trying to get as small as they could. And Jim said to himself, if I could just fit inside my helmet, I'd be safe. And he thought about that for many, well, for a number of years during the war. And he had a captain over in Germany that did nose artwork. And he's the one who helped with that captain design the helmet with the 2 feet and the two eyeballs looking out from underneath the helmet with some other things that they were he was doing inside the helmet. And that airplane, he flew a number of missions. And he passed away, so I asked his widow, his wife, if she had any photos of it, because Jim had said to me that he had taken a photo of it, and she dug it up and found it, and I told her, if you send me a copy of it, I'll put it on my L2 in Jim's honor. He was such a nice man, and I told her that I was going to have it done at Lock Haven at the Sentimental Journey Fly-In, and I invited her up to watch the nose art being applied. And the gentleman, Frank Scheffler, did the nose art, came down from New York and met me there. And under her direction, the widow's direction, Frank painted the nose art exactly as she remembered. It was a black and white photo we were working from, obviously, from back then, from what he had explained to her the colors were, her husband. Watched it along with, she ended up bringing her sister and some friends, and we made a party of it. It was quite a lot of fun. And so every time I land over at the airport, she actually lives on an airport. They had built a house on an airport. She always runs out to Jim's airplane when I land. So she's quite a character and gets a big kick out of it.
There'll be a photo on the website. And how long have you had her?
I think it's 8 to 9 years now.
And you said you had a little bit of haze coming up when I came up to you on your airplane. What were you doing? You want to give a hint on how you fly a liaison airplane from Washington, D.C. to Reading, Pennsylvania?
Well, the magic word there is the Washington, D.C. If you're into aviation, you understand that there's a highly restricted airspace around the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. So this airplane does not have electric. So we have designed and installed electric through batteries and chargers, etc., so that I'm able to fly in and out of controlled airspace, which is what's around Washington, Baltimore area. So along with the radios that I'm required to carry, I also have a GPS. So this hazy, nasty day, we slid up here following the GPS.
Well, we'll forgive you, because on the flight line, surrounded by all these World War II tents, and you've hit it, it looks really good.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's painted like it was in 43.
Well, Mike, I won't keep it because I know you got to finish packing up the airplane, but I appreciate you taking some time, and hopefully you have a good weekend this weekend.
Anytime. Thank you.
The Supermarine Spitfire.
Okay, that's it for this episode. We'll return next week with the usual format, including an interesting guest. I'd like to thank Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron from PlaneCrazyDownUnder.com for the Australia Desk Report. Be sure to see AirplaneGeeks.com for show notes and listener comments, as well as those photos I mentioned by David of the Mid-Atlantic Air Museum's World War II commemorative weekend. You can follow us on Twitter at AirplaneGeeks. Send email to thegeeks@AirplaneGeeks.com. Also, be sure to visit our fan page on Facebook. You can also leave us a message on our listener line. That's 361-GEEKS-01, which is also 361-433-5701. We're happy to get your topic suggestions, guest recommendations, or just say hello. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Mr. Fisher, I think you can take him home now.
Do I have to?
Please.
I'm sorry. Nice one.
Please, would you?
Sorry, I laughed. I'm sorry.
Okay, all right. We'll stop the recording here. Excellent.
We can work just do that, please, would you? I laughed.
Please, would you?
Lovely.
Sorry. Okay, cool. Done.